WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
About 10 minutes after 4 o'clock, you're listening to WUHY-FM in Philadelphia, and this is Fresh Air. My name is Danny Miller. My guest, right with me right now, is Stephen Feld, an ethnomusicologist who now teaches courses in sound communications at the Annenberg School of Communications at the University of Pennsylvania. Ethnomusicology is a combination of disciplines. It draws on the techniques of anthropology and musicology and attempts to learn about a culture through its music. My guest, Stephen, has taken that premise a step further and has been looking at different cultures in terms of their sound environments, in addition to studying and composing the music of those different cultures. His field work includes living with the Kaluli tribe in Papua New Guinea, and he did that with Buck and Bambley Shiflin, two anthropologists who visited Fresh Air last Tuesday, and Stephen's also lived with Native Americans in the southwestern United States. Stephen's also a jazz musician and came to ethnomusicology through his study and appreciation of jazz. We're going to spend the rest of Fresh Air today discussing how the sound environment and music influences the social interaction and cultural values of a society. We'll also be hearing excerpts of tapes recorded by Steve during his fieldwork. Steve, welcome back to Fresh Air. Actually, you were on the show about 6 or 7 months ago to talk about your New Guinea work. Can we start out by, if you could say a little bit about what interests you about ethnomusicology and how you first got involved with it?
Well, I first came to ethnomusicology, like many people, through jazz, and that's that particular pattern follows because of the relationship between jazz and African music. And many of the scholars who did some of the earliest work in African music were actually jazz musicians, like Alan Waterman and Richard Alan Merriam and Richard Waterman, and I became interested in ethnomusicology because I felt that it provided a perspective on music which where the normal tradition, where the center of the tradition was improvised music, rather than the center of the tradition being notated music, which is the Western European art music situation.
There's actually it works both ways in terms of jazz being setting you up for an appreciation of international or different cultures' music, because that seems to fit into a lot of different jazz.
Right. There's been a history, of course, of a lot of interaction of jazz and other music. Jazz musicians have used Afro-Cuban and African sounds for quite a long time, as well as sounds from many other places. When Ravi Shankar first became popular in the United States, he was hanging out a lot at the Institute for Ethnomusicology at UCLA, where Don Ellis and a lot of other jazz musicians were also working. Of course, Don Ellis and his quarter tone trumpet and his Hindustani jazz sextet, that was a fusion of Eastern and jazz. And Herbie Mann and Chick Corea and many musicians have worked with musical modes and meters outside of Western European art music.
You had mentioned to me the other day a particularly, very good example of Ornette Coleman's use of some of the emotional qualities of crying almost, mm-hmm. in his playing, which is also sort of borrowed from practices of other cultures.
Yes, that there's a particular piece called Sadness, which I find very poignant because the society that I've worked in the most, the Kaluli in Papua New Guinea, the Kaluli have a lot of sounds which are related to sadness, and they do a lot with sound expression in both weeping and song, relating to evoking feelings of and sentiments of sadness.
Well, you actually brought some excerpts of recordings that you made when you were living with the Kaluli in mm-hmm. New Guinea. And should we get to that first one now and also...
Okay, let's talk about this first thing. The first recording is a duet between two women. And the Kaluli, among other things, very much like to sing by waterfalls. These two women were working in the gardens, and they stopped and took a break, and they're sitting high above a waterfall, and they begin to sing. Now, this kind of singing they do, they call it waterfall singing, in fact, because one part is supposed to flow over the other. One of the very strong ideas related to Western European art music is a notion of linear time. The Kaluli don't have a notion of linear time in their music. They have a notion of layered time and layered space in the music, and the parts are supposed to lift up over one another and be rather spherical and cyclical rather than linear. And this is a concept which a lot of jazz musicians have also explored, and it's very interesting to listen to these and then listen to jazz selections because we hear similar things. In fact, I played certain jazz pieces for Kaluli because I wanted to see if it would strike any kind of responsive chord. And the piece we're going to hear is called Wani Nuo. It's two women, and the text is in two parts. One part is called the trunk, and the other part is called the branches. And they flow over one another, layering throughout the piece.
Shall we hear?
Yes, let's listen to that and then go on.
One in a way, one in a wo,
one in a wo,
one in a wo,
one in a wo.
Okay, that was one of the field recordings which Stephen Feld, an ethnomusicologist, has made on during his field work in Papua New Guinea with the Kaluli people there. And Stephen, you had also played some jazz to them to get a sense of how they responded to the jazz. And what we're about to hear in a moment is a composition by Miles Davis, Nefertiti. Why is that a song that you want to
put? Well, I had this intuition that the aesthetic tension and the real feeling, what made a difference in the way these things were performed, was in the interaction of the two voices, that they layer just next to each other, and the next time they spread it out, and then the next time they spread it out a little more, and they overlap a little longer one time, and then a little closer the next time, and so forth. And I tried to think of similar kinds of music that I knew, which had layering effects, which had time which was cyclical and spherical rather than linear, which I could play for them and try and discuss, try and get some kind of notion as to whether this is really what their aesthetic intention was. And indeed, it was the case. And one thing which many people liked very, very much was Miles Davis's Nefertiti.
Okay, let's hear that now. Thank you. That's Nefertiti, a Miles Davis composition, which Stephen Feld played for some of the people in Papua New Guinea, the Kaluli people that he was living with. Did you want to say something about that?
Yeah. One of the things that you try and do when you work with other people and understand conceptualization, which leads to the production of their music, is to look at very traditional Western musical concepts, one of those being unison. I was interested in whether the Kaluli liked unison, whether they could produce music in unison, whether there was a concept of unison. One of the things that's most interesting to me about them is that they understand unison perfectly well because Christian hymns and things like that are sung in unison, except they don't value it at all. They say that music, when it's good, should flow like water. And the notion is like arching over a waterfall, that it has to be layer. There has to be a constant shimmering of sound. It's not that there's a distinct stop and start in between parts. So when you have the two women singing the exact same line, but singing it one after the other, leading sometimes a little more space, sometimes a little less space, like with the interaction of the saxophone and the trumpet in Nefertiti, you have something which borders on unison, but never is quite unison. And each time the space changes a little bit. And that's where the fun is. That's where the interaction is between the two performers. So like water, and also like birds, which Kaluli were very quick to point out to me, never sing in unison, music must be layered. It must flow, and it must carry over. But it never is linear. There's never an end point and a start point, because water and birds, and there are no sounds in the world which are like that. And that very strongly influences their conceptualization of tempo.
Let me ask you a fairly basic question about your approach to ethnomusicology, keeping in mind like what might be going through your head when you're living in a different culture, mm-hmm. when you're doing field work. I read in a book on ethnomusicology that there are some different orientations that you can take towards studying music of other mm-hmm. cultures that are typically taken, like sometimes being protective of wanting to preserve that music, wanting to see if there's any hopes for cross-cultural communication through music. What's your perspective in your own work?
Well, let me start out by saying that there really has always been a traditional sort of split in the field between those people who had more of a musicological orientation and those people who had more of an anthropological one. The more musicological orientation led to definitions of ethnomusicology as music of exotic societies or music of non-Western peoples, whereas the more anthropological definitions tended to be the study of music as a social phenomena, a study of music in culture, or the understanding music as a way of understanding how the world is socially put together for different people. I come out of that second approach much more. I was trained as a musician, but then I became an anthropologist precisely because I felt there was a real short-sightedness in the music academy toward musical phenomena in other cultures. And that is that musicologists tend to study sound as sound. They don't see it as a human thing, as a product of human behavior, as a product of human conceptualization, as something that people do for each other, with each other, in order to be social. And this is really the primary fact about music which would lead one to take an ethnographic or an anthropological approach, go somewhere, live with the people, learn the language, and start from the ground up.
Now, when you do that, I'd imagine, and this is an issue which would be common to both anthropology and ethnomusicology, is how can you be there without your presence somehow disrupting or changing the environment or what you're going to observe around you?
Well, you can never be a fly on the wall. I mean, some people pretend this is so, and many books are written as if the anthropologist or musicologist was not there. But of course, this is not so. You influence everything. The trick is to really be conscious of it and to understand exactly how, and to take a role, decide on a role, and make it a positive one in the community. Now, the Kaluli were told by Buck and Bambi Shefflin, my friends who invited me to Bosavi to work with him, that I was a song man in my own land, and that I was coming because I really wanted to learn about their music. When I came, the Kaluli were, in a sense, primed for that. And that really helped things tremendously. And so they knew what I was after. But there are other things which indicate very basic factors to people. For instance, if I hear a song once or twice, I have a pretty good musical memory, and I would remember it, and I would sing it back to people and do things like that. That got the point across fairly quickly that I was really interested in sound.
Did you find that in your listening to Kaluli music that you might listening with Western ears or the ears that you grew up with, you know, injecting what would be irrelevant cultural biases into how you interpreted that?
Yeah, that's always a problem.
Could you share something, how that could be misleading, how that might mislead how you evaluate or understand?
Well, if for instance, every time, you know, you sit with a group of people and you're listening to their music in a ceremonial context or even in a context where you're just recording it to learn something about it, if you sit there and you tap your foot in a meter of 4-4 or 3-4 or something like that, I mean, this wildly sets up a crazy kind of situation. While I was in the field, I made no attempt to musically transcribe songs. I textually transcribed it and worked with the language quite extensively in the songs. But I didn't transcribe the music, but what I did do instead was try and sing with them as much as possible. And the method for doing this is very simple, and it works very well. You record the songs, then you take them and transfer them to a cassette, and then you sit down with a couple sets of headphones with the people you want to work with, and you listen to phrases, and you work on the language and so forth. But as you do it, you sing along, and you sing back, and you make mistakes deliberately and so forth, and then you get a real intuitive musical sense to yourself, just how these things are constructed. And then what that ultimately leads to is composing your own songs and beginning to get a sense of how they're really put together. And that had much more of a positive effect on my understanding of the structure than typical musicological techniques in transcription, trying to put them in a meter. So for me, the major stumbling block is really putting aside Western concepts of time. Do you want to go on to the second piece?
Yeah, because this is another example of how a cultural bias that, you know, you would just expect to be a normal thing, you know, all of a sudden when you look back and see how it's entered your thinking, it really does have an effect on how you're studying something. What is this next example that you want to play?
Well, this was recorded in the Southwest in the Pueblo of Santo Domingo. The singer is a Native American whose name is Harold Littlebird. And I had been recording Native American songs and was interested in modern songs that were being composed. And Harold composes many modern songs. And this is a song poem called Talking 49, which is about 49 songs, the experience of young Indians. I recorded this song and many others many, many times. And every time when I would play it back and try and talk with them, I would get silence or I would get horrified looks on their faces. And this really upset me because I really like good recordings. And I think that it's important for ethnomusicologists to make recordings which are really well engineered from the sound point of view and which can be disseminated by record and radio and so forth. Well, I finally went to a 49, which is a sort of powwow sing, and I heard the sound of the drum in the context, the way it's supposed to be. And that completely changed everything, and I started to talk to Harold, and then I realized what was wrong. The way Indians sing, they like the sound of the voice to sound like it's right next to your ear, just really almost blasting you away. It's an extraordinary presence of these all-night things. But the drum has to be muffled. It has to sound like it's coming from the other side of the hill. And in all the recordings I made, the drum and the voice were too close to each other. And so we re-recorded Talking 49, and it sounds like this. And the drum now has the proper auditory perspective in relationship to the voice. And having made that mistake once, I now pay a lot of attention to the difference between good engineering techniques from a Western point of view and the sort of ethno-aesthetic problem of recording properly for spatial dimension as the people think of it.
Okay, well, let's hear that example now, which Stephen Feld recorded when living in the Southwest United States with the Native Americans there.
A friend who sells hot dogs asked me once, "What's a 49 anyway?" "It's many things," I said. "It's voices. It's singing. It's laughing. It's being together and happy. It's dancing. It's praying. It's power. It's drums or boxes beaten on. It's sharing stories from a long ways. It's seeing people growing old. It's fighting back the boundaries of cities. It's mountains and plains and open country. It is the peak of what once was. It is the struggling in our eyes seen today. It is all these and more. More than words or thoughts earthbound. It is all skies and all people. It is oldness and being young. It is timeless and unforgettable. It is language that makes stars dance. It is voices thundering that lift mountains. So you see, my curious friend, a 49 is much to some, and all to another. It is these I have spoken of, and it is a power that is always there. And last night in Black Canyon, it was there. Yo, we yo, ha, yo, yo, hey, ha, yo, we yo, hey, ho, we yo, hey, 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 yo, we yo, ha, yo, yo, hey, ha, yo, we yo, hey, ho, we yo, hey, hey, yo, hey, ha, yo, we yo, hey, ho, we yo, hey, 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 yo, we yo, ha, yo, yo, hey, ha, yo, we yo, hey, ho, we yo, hey, hey. Yo, hey, hi, yo, we all, hey, ho, hey, oh, hey, all, hey, 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 yo, hey, yo, we all, hi, yo, yo, hey, hi, yo, we all, hey, ho, hey, oh, hey, 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 yo, we all, hi, yo, yo, hey, hi, yo, we all, hey, oh, hey, oh, hey, 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 yo, hey, hi, yo, we all, hi, yo, hey, oh, hey, oh, hey, 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 yo, we all, hi, hey, you don't want to go up there. They ain't got no drum. It's just a box. They're just beating on a box. Stay here with the drum. Hey, where are you from? Santo Domingo, but I live in town. Yeah? I was there once. Sure like them dances. Lots of dancers. Want a beer? You ever been north? Come visit me this summer. Come to Crow Fair. Ask for me. Levi Pepion. Everybody knows me. You got a place to stay.
An excerpt of a field recording which my guest, ethnomusicologist Stephen Feld, did when he was made when he was out in Southwest America.
Well, that piece, which is part of a long story poem called Talking 49 by Harold Littlebird, is an illustration of recording as an ethno-aesthetic problem. And whereas recordists tend to think that recording just means taking a tape recorder, a microphone, gathering recordings from far-off places, and that's one way to collect folk music or ethnomusicological materials, one of the things that I've become particularly wary of is how, even at this level, even at recording, there's an interaction which has to take place between the recordist and the musicians, and this is built up upon social ideas about what music is supposed to sound like. Harold had a very specific idea about what the voice should be and what the drum should be and the speaking and the spatial presence and how this should sound like a 49. But I hadn't experienced that, and he couldn't explain it to me.
What was the spatial presence on the initial recordings that you made that just didn't make it when...
Well, the drum had a real crisp kind of close sound coming out of one speaker and on the other speaker, you know, phased back and forth on both sides with the voice, and it had the presence was brought down so that it mixed with the drum in a traditional kind of Western way, the way anybody would learn how to make a proper sound recording. From the point of view of an engineer, this recording is a little it's a little bit on the edge. The voice has a little bit too much presence. It's a little bit too edgy, too strong, and the drum is too muffled. It's too distant. But that's exactly the context in which this music is always heard, and that's the way they wanted to hear it on the recording.
It's a sense of hearing the music in the context of the environment that it was...
Yeah, it's a sense that music is not just music, that music is an auditory kind of phenomena which takes place in a space, and you want to hear it the way it is supposed to be heard in the space in which it's performed. Just as those women singing at the waterfall, it would have been easy to get rid of the sound of the waterfall. But of course, to them, singing by the waterfall is the important thing.
How do different sound environments that you've been in, everything from, I guess, a rainforest, which is pretty quiet, mm-hmm. to other things that aren't so quiet, how do those different sound environments affect the approach to music and composition taken?
Well, I think different notions of acoustic ecology, different notions of acoustic space affect a whole lot of judgments about not just specific sounds, but the layering of sounds, the way sounds go together. I think if there's one thing that Western musicology tends to do, which is very destructive, is that it isolates music. It isolates song and reifies it. In an environment like Bosavi, in Papua New Guinea, what I learned right off was that I couldn't just say I was interested in music, because music meant waterfalls, and music meant birds, and music meant insects, and music meant the whole sounds of the environment.
How did that affect the concept of the musician? As it was a musician, a special role in the society? Were there musicians, only certain people musicians, or did everybody have...
No, the Kaluli are a very egalitarian group of people. It's not a stratified society, so there's no professional musicians, there's no caste of people who are musicians. There isn't a term musician which is applied to specific people. Everybody is involved in composing and singing and sound in one way or another, whether it's knowing the right way to call your dogs or the right way to call your pigs or recognizing what birds or singing along with the cicadas in the afternoon just for fun or making up sound puns or games composing very involved songs with detailed poetic texts, which involve a lot of skill.
Well, what would be the concept of good music then? How's musical quality measured in that type of context where musicianship is not really belongs to just people, mm-hmm. consider themselves musicians, but really belongs to everybody?
There are several key notions about evaluation. In the performance context, the most important kind of evaluation for Kaluli ceremonies is that the song moves someone to tears. Songs that are composed for ceremonies, of which the Kaluli traditionally had five, but there are three of them, which are really, this is very focused. The songs are composed with poetic lines which have lots of place names in them, lots of references to different things which can refer to people's past or to a deceased friend or something like that, a garden place where people once worked together and so forth. These are supposed to make people sentimental, nostalgic, and sad. And when they are moved to tears, that is a very overt performative sort of reconfirmation of the moving nature of the song. Now, in other settings, people do openly respond with some sort of aesthetic commentary or another. But one of the things which has traditionally been said about small-scale primitive societies is that they lack verbalized aesthetic commentaries, that this is an example of a difference between art music and so-called primitive music. And I think this is absolutely not so. I mean, the Kaluli would sit around my tape recorder and work with me transcribing a song, and they would remember the whole history of the song, and they would talk about it, and they talk about why this line was poetically powerful and why this image worked and why this one didn't and so forth. And they would really get into it, and they would talk about this person's voice becoming like this kind of bird or that kind of bird or something like that. And they became completely worked up by this. And I think that I don't think this was a behavior that they were doing for my benefit. I think this is something which is very basic in many societies. It's just people haven't put themselves, not that many people have put themselves in situations where they really try and go after that as a core kind of focus in their research.
Shall we hear the next example, which is also from your field work with the Kaluli?
Yeah, this is about 20 men working, clearing a ridge for a garden area. And this just gives you some sense of the sonic environment in which this music takes place. Here you can hear the layering of song, axes cutting trees down, birds, people whooping, laughing, having a good time. And this is really what you hear on an everyday basis in a place like Bosavi. It's not the single song that you hear.
Which is to say that in the aesthetic enjoyment of that, it's when somebody's listening, they're not just listening to the song, but it really is a participation of all the sound elements.
Right, right. And they all just, they fit together into something which, when you listen to it after the fact, seems orchestrated, but it's just happening all the time.
Okay, let's hear that right now. Another example of a field recording which Stephen Feld made when living with the Kaluli people in Papua New Guinea.
Yeah.
How do you feel that? Well, here's one very type of exotic sound environment in mm-hmm. terms of you don't have cars, you don't have mm-hmm. the noise of traffic, you don't have amplified radios or televisions and so forth, but you have a lot of natural sound.
Right.
How do you think the sound environment of a particular setting affects the type of social interaction that people develop in that setting?
Well, first of all, in a small scale, face-to-face kind of society, the number of natural and human sounds that you have make up 95% of the sounds of the entire environment. Maybe 5% of the sounds of the environment would be tools. Whereas in post-industrial society, 95% of the sounds would be tools, and 5% of them would be human and natural. In terms of what you hear on an everyday basis, if you just think in quantitative terms, monitoring the sounds, it's harder to find quiet in in a Western environment, obviously, than an environment like this. Nevertheless, the Kaluli love yelling. They love making noise. They love a good whoop. They love knocking a tree down, and so forth. There's a great side of their exuberance, which is portrayed by demonstrating your space with sound, walking up to somebody who's a relation and whooping kind of in their face. The name of your kinship relation or something like this. This is a way of demonstrating great fondness and presence. So their sound environment is one which, on a sort of qualitative end, has a lot less noise, a lot more signal. That is, most of the sounds that you hear all the time are the sounds you want to be attending to. You can hear every sound distinctly. You can always hear the birds. You can always hear the water. You can always hear the thunder. You can always... Now, at the same time, they also can be scared quite a bit by sound. And one of the stories which I was told, and one of the events which happened in the history of the Bosavi people, which I think probably made them more fearful or as fearful as anything that's ever happened to them, was when they heard the first airplane that went over the area in 1936. It freaked people out. They couldn't see it, but they heard the sound, and people thought that perhaps a mountain was erupting, that it was a volcano or something. They couldn't figure out what it was. So loud, dramatic, demonstrative sound really does have an effect. At the same time, it's an environment where there really isn't very much auditory privacy, and people don't whisper.
I wonder if that has anything to do with the fact that, you know, in America, in cities anyway, there's laws regulating sound. In other words, yeah. You know, like after 11 o'clock, perhaps, if your stereo is on too loud, then you might be able to get the police to come to your house and tell you to... Turn it down. Is there any type of regulation, similar regulation?
Well, there's no regulation because there's no need for a regulation. In a sense, there's no overpopulation of sounds in the environment. If there were an overpopulation of sounds in the environment, what that would mean is that Kaluli could not hear the sounds they want to hear as distinctly as they like to hear them, say birds and so forth. And then I think it would be serious.
There'd be some social action of one type or another.
Yes, but in our environment, the main problem is that we have noise legislation, which is there's two aspects of it, qualitative and quantitative. You can make noise legislation which just says you can't have noise over a certain decibel level, but that really doesn't have very much to do with human values. That doesn't have to do with human communities very much. That doesn't have to do with how far away from a specific church its bell rings in any one direction. I just mentioned here, I was at the patent office recently and have a list of recent sound inventions which got patent numbers. And these, I think, are really indicative of lots of things about values in our society. There is a tremendous proliferation of white noise generators to help people sleep, high-frequency welding materials to replace needle and thread, ultrasonic stuff, ultrasonic washing machines to bathe people without soap and water. Pocket alarms are now registered in the patent office, whose sound intensity is as high as 118 decibels, and 120 decibels is normally considered the area of the threshold of pain, and 85 decibels, of course, is the area that's involved in all these noise laws. Ultrasound transmitters for getting rid of mice and squirrels, pocket alarms to repel mosquitoes at 120 feet, all these voice lie detectors, and so forth. I mean, it goes on and on, and there's just too much sound. There's too much proliferation.
And it's mechanically produced.
Well, what it does is it eliminates and it changes the whole notion of architectural space in our environment. It changes the environment. It changes the radius of relationships between people. It breaks down face-to-face communication, whereas sound in an environment like Bosavi really favors face-to-face communication, direct interaction between people.
Well, we're about out of time, so let's move along real quickly to the last example of sound that you brought with you. Can you tell us why, what it is and why you brought it?
Well, my recent research has kind of moved out of these more exotic situations and into my own culture a little bit. Teaching in a school of communications and working in that area, I've been thinking a lot about mass media and have begun to do research on the evolution of sound effects. And one of the things that has particularly interested me is the evolution of sound stereotypes of non-Western musics. And this is another kind of interesting link with ethnomusicology. I mean, one interesting area for ethnomusicologists to study would be, say, the soundtracks for movies of the Mondo Cani genre, because these really give us a nice indication of our social construction of what primitive music is about. Anyway, the piece that I brought with is something which was on the Walt Disney Mickey Mouse Club every week. It's called Fun with Music. It's something that I listened to an awful lot as a kid. Once a week was Fun with Music Day on the Mickey Mouse Club, and it began with Mickey danced up as a song and dance man, and he came out, and then the Mouseketeers did this song called Fun with Music, and let's play it, and then we can talk about it.
Fun with music, and before we are done, just wait and see, you'll all agree, fun with music is fun, fun for everyone.
Fun with music, making music is fun. Voila!
Cece sang a song of home or some foreign land. Music is the language we all understand.
Sure, we're for one with music, fun with music, down on Old Erin's Isle.
You wait and see, you all agree, fun with music is fun, fun for everyone.
Well, what I think we heard some international stereotypical sense of what...
Spanish, French, Italian, Irish, and then of course the da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, the Asian. Well, these sound stereotypes, of course, are constructed. They're constructed by orchestrators who work in studios, and then they become part of popular images. They don't just come out of the air, and this is one of the things I'm particularly interested in looking at now, the social situation surrounding this. And in the case of the Asian sound stereotypes, it was particularly World War II had a very important role.
Well, Steve, we're out of time, and I wish we had at least a few more minutes to speak, but thank you very much for for bringing your thoughts and the examples of your work that you've recorded in the field and some of the other sounds you're thinking and listening to. I've been speaking with Stephen Feld, who is an ethnomusicologist and who now teaches courses in sound communications at the University of Pennsylvania in the Annenberg School of Communications. And that's it for today's Fresh Air. On Monday, Terry Gross will be back, and at 2 o'clock, we'll also have Bill Seemring, our general manager, on the program to discuss some of the ongoing program thinking and decision making at WUHY, and to take some of your phone calls and comments and questions in our what we call our Dialogue with Listeners feature every month. At 3:30, Judy Stein will be discussing some of the art now exhibiting in the Delaware Valley. And at 4 o'clock, we're going to start a special series which will be begun because we've run out of Marion McPartland piano jazz programs. At least the series has stopped for the time being. But we'll be featuring a series of concerts and interviews with jazz musicians and music workshops. And on Monday, we're going to hear the first part of a two-part program with John Johnson, who is the host of WUHY's Musical Stage and an instructor at Temple University, where he teaches, among other things, courses on American popular song.